Group meeting, Saturday, 25th July, 1987. You may remember last time we stopped at the point where Moses was afraid to carry out what Elohim said out of the burning bush. This was the first occasion, apparently, as far as the biblical record goes, of Moses being in the supremely meditative state. Because that's what the conversation with transcendence always means, that that person has entered the profoundest state in which he is in sympathy, is not a strong enough word, he is in union with transcendence. It is the uncharted abyss, empty of everything that a mortal knows. Deep in his psyche, that is, in the psyche of Moses, is the degrading hidden force of his shortcomings. Normally, this union with transcendence, or this entry into the consciousness, which is the consciousness of transcendence, takes place only after all shortcomings have been understood and purified. But sometimes it is given to an individual to have the communion without being completely free of shortcomings. That's his particular destiny. That happens again and again. Moses is diffident, he hesitates, and Yahweh is angered. Now, of course, that was their way of putting it, but to suggest that transcendence gets angry, of course, as such is nonsensical. It has no meaning whatever. Transcendence cannot get angry. Transcendence just looks on, takes no sides one way or the other. Because transcendence is the creator and is itself the embodiment of perfect law, which works itself out inevitably and invariably. But it means that Neshama, the divine innermost spark of the soul in Moses, beyond sin, waxes hot with shame at the weakness of Nefesh, the natural soul. You know, the Hebrews had that term Nefesh, when it is said that the Lord God made Adam and breathed into his nostrils, and Adam became a soul, had a soul, you see. That is the what Aristotle quite rightly called the animal soul, Nefesh. And that is our psyche as such. The psyche being rooted in the brain and the nervous system, being influenced by the activity of the ductless glands, the state of the blood and the general physical health of the body, displays both all the qualities inherent in that particular organism. Inherent as well as those which have been developed, nurtured, fostered by the parents, by the environment, by the culture of the times, and so forth. It is the conditions, it is the conditioned psyche. The psyche is always conditioned. Neshama is the Hebrew word for what is commonly called the spark of the divine. That cannot do wrong, that cannot sin, and so forth. And that is the all-knowing. But that all-knowingness never comes down into the human brain. We don't know it and its functioning with the brain. We come to know it with the brain only after there is considerable, if not total, purification of the psyche. So, Neshama, of course, I have written, waxes hot with shame. Because the outstanding characteristic in the brain of the person himself is that of being ashamed of his weaknesses. But the decree from Yahweh has gone forth. Israel shall be redeemed and the oppressor humbled. But Yahweh is also the Lord, full of mercy, hesed, and of compassion, rahamim. Rahamim is also an Arabic word. So he promises Moses the help of his elder brother Aaron, who can speak well. The gift of speech is there with him. It's very interesting that that should come out in Exodus like that, because Zarathustra probably preceded Moses by a small period of time. Probably. I'm not certain about that. It's very difficult to be certain of Zarathustra's date. Also of Moses' exact date, because our dates in the Bible are Archbishop Usher's dates, who declared that the world was made on the 4th of October at 9 a.m., 4004 B.C. How on earth he got there? Well, we'd have to ask him, and we can't do that. Probably he won't tell if he could get at him. So now, this oppressor and the redeemed, and being redeemed, this comes in the Zarathustrian idea also, the original teaching, that he was sent by Ahura Mazda to redeem mankind, save man from the false teachings of those who degraded themselves into the practice of black magic, as it was called. And when Zarathustra prays to Ahura Mazda to grant that Asha, truth, and Armaiti, divine devotion, would come to him and to his followers, Ahura Mazda replies that we present Almighty unto all of you, the good and the bad alike. This is extremely interesting. You see, we are so brought up and so conditioned to think of the Supreme, whether it's regarded as a being or as an impersonal reality or truth or whatever you like to call it, is something all good. Who defines all good? I do and you do. We are imperfect creatures. Our definition is an exclusive definition. The actuality is the totality. And the totality includes what you and I would call evil. And what is it that you and I would call evil? That which is hurtful, painful, that which we do not like. What do we call good? That which is pleasant, agreeable to us, that which we like. So you see, we are conditioned in such a way that we are exclusive of the totality as it is. Now, when Zarathustra prays this, his followers say, may he be granted sweet speech, the power of sweet speech. It's very instructive if you sort of go deeply into all the implications of what is actually written in the scriptures. So the brothers meet. Where do they meet? They meet in the Mount of God. Now, can two separate men meet thus, Moses and Aaron? I think the way to understand it is this. When you have ascended to the Mount of God, there is no you. What is the Mount of God? In Kundalini Yoga, there's the Sahasrara Chakra, where you meet Shiva. When the serpent fire is aroused and it ascends right up the spine and culminates in the thousand-petaled lotus in the brain there like that, the cortex. That is where Shiva resides, you see. That is the Mount of God. In Zarathustrian teachings, it's Ushidarena. In the Hindu writings, it's Mount Meru. And here it is the Mount of God. And you remember how in Matthew chapter 5, because the multitude which followed Jesus was so large, he went up into the mount where only his chosen disciples followed. Which means that he entered that deep state of consciousness which was possible for him alone. And from there, he gave out the Sermon on the Mount. So when your brother also has there ascended, you will not find him. There is no you in the Mount of God. There is no brother or no other in the Mount. The whole consciousness of otherness is transcended entirely, so that you have a true cosmic consciousness in the real sense. The unity of Yahweh is not of space and time, not of event or person. There is no seeking. Space and time and event and person are measured, moving, mortal. But in Yahweh there is no death. Yahweh is still silent, the Sabbath, the state of eternal rest. to meet in the Mount of God a spiritual induction and the unity of Yahweh unblemished. You see, when the teacher, who is really the perfected Holy One, teaches, he might use words in the language, but the profounder teaching takes place silently between teacher and disciple. See, the disciple has to be sufficiently developed to be able to be completely sensitive to that which emanates in mind, pure mind, from the teacher. This is the communion between teacher and disciple in the act of teaching by the teacher and learning by the disciple. The brothers met and kissed. It is said that they kissed. What does that mean? I mean, two men meeting in the Mount of God. It's absolutely not literal. It's symbolical. Who kisses who? Someone who loves another kisses. They kiss each other. It's a symbol of love. In the Bible it said the brothers met and kissed. Love's seal on the service of God. That is its meaning. This service begins when men are ripe. Aaron was 84 years old. Only 3 years younger than I am. 2 years younger. He was 85. Moses was 80. But beware of these numbers which are always given in the books of Moses, the five books, the Torah. They are not to be taken literally. They have their own symbolical meaning. You see, the Hebrews had developed an extraordinary system, the gematria, as it was called. Each letter of the alphabet had a special number attached to it, you see. And each letter had its own metaphysical significance. Now, you might wonder how you can embody a whole metaphysic in a single letter of the Hebrew alphabet. But you see, the Hebrew alphabet, the letters of the alphabet, are sounded like our Latin or Greek or English alphabet. In Greek we have alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon, zeta, eta, theta, etc. Now, when you sound a single letter and then write it out in full, it consists of several letters. Get the idea? So now, if you read the original Hebrew and you know the whole system of the gematria, that each letter has a certain number attached to it, and that number and letter has its metaphysical significance, you will find a tremendous amount of knowledge embodied in the writings. I mean, it would take hundreds of years to unravel the whole of Genesis and Exodus and so on, if we started right now. because the words of the Hebrew language are composed of so many letters, and as each letter is also sounded as if it was composed of so many other letters. It's a tremendously complex system, but not a complicated system. We must remember that. What is complicated is ill, is unwell. You know how a doctor says, well, the operation was successful, but complications set in. And the man suffered from this, that, or the other, or he died, or whatever it is. Complication means disorder, doesn't it? But whatsoever is a living organism is in perfect order when it is, as long as it is healthy. So it is a complex system. The human body, for instance, is a miraculously complex system. Only the other day I was reading in the late issue of the Scientific American that scientists working on the brain have declared now that it is so complex, and it stands for so much and does so much that we have hardly begun to unravel all its mysteries. And yet we have an immense knowledge about the brain by now. And if this is what they say, whilst researching on a particular part of the brain, you can imagine what a wonderful thing the human organism is, especially the brain. It is said that, you know, the brain is a marvelous computer too. No man-made computer comes anywhere near it. If man started manufacturing a computer to represent just the main aspects of the activity of the brain, that computer would be bigger than St. Paul's Cathedral. So we've got all that inside the brain. I say that inside this little bony box of ours, the whole universe is present. Don't forget, there are 13 billion cells making up the human brain. 13,000 million cells. The brain as such, it is estimated, contains at any one moment, I mean not of the newborn infant, but of the adult, 100 trillion bits of information. If you were to write it all out in language, in the ordinary way, it would take up 20 million volumes the size of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, the shape of your life is determined by the peak on which you stand. Your standing ground is your inmost awareness, which is your point of transcendence. Your inmost awareness is there. And it is your point of transcendence, where Shiva resides. All your feeling and thought, speech and action is the expression of that awareness. Your standing ground changes. Whilst you are ignorant, disobedient, sinful, you are a pawn of fate, a tool of evil. Your peak is submerged in darkness. You see, one might very well ask, if transcendence resides here like that, why do we have our difficulties and problems and ignorance and mistakes and all the rest of it? Simply because this organism, the human organism, has had an evolution in material terms. It has developed materially, starting with the fish first. And when the fish became landlubbers, their fins began to develop into our limbs as such, and so forth. And of course, we have this course of evolution of several hundreds of millions of years through the reptiles, the mammals, the primates, and all the rest of it. And so we inherit, and that inheritance is all lodged in the brain. We inherit all the characteristics of the non-human evolution. You see? So your peak is submerged in darkness. But if you care with pure passion, passion not in the nasty sense, but passion in the pure sense, the intensity of aspiration, of longing, if you care with pure passion, your peak is bathed in light. You stand on holy ground, on the peak which is God's, not yours. And on this peak you are showered with transcendent blessing. This is the immortal. But you, the shape and life, which is the ephemeral body psyche, are part of mortality. I have written actually body-mind. I should have written psyche, but this differentiation between psyche and body came to me only later, after all this was written. A part of mortality. Body-mind is the stuff of duality. Body-psyche, the psyche is the originator of duality. Life as such is the medium through which the dualism comes into being and functions ordinarily. Everything in life is dual. Male, female, positive, negative, attractive, repulsive, and so forth. That's how life is able to manifest through a medium, whether it be the human being or an animal, a tree, or whatever it is. Body-mind is the stuff of duality, conflict, wear and tear. Its movement through time and space is doomed to include error, fading away, disintegration. So, the organism necessarily perishes, whether your standing ground is submerged in darkness or bathed in light. So, he who bore the name Enoch or Moses or Elijah or Jesus died. Every human being, however perfect he becomes, however much he realizes communion with transcendence, the organism necessarily dies. But if you do ascend into the Mount of the Lord and stand on the peak which is God's, the transcendent blessing showered on you will so shape your life and influence on earth that men will not forget God, and your name will be a deep bed, a long bed for the overflowing stream of God's abundance for ages to come. You see how the religions which were founded by the perfected holy ones have lived for thousands of years. Look at Judaism. 3,000 or 4,000 years it has lived. The same with Zarathustrianism. Buddhism has had a slightly shorter life, 25 centuries. Christianity has had 20 centuries. Islam has had 13 centuries. And Sikhism has had even less. Do not then weep for the mistakes you make. Only the self-conceited cannot endure to be in the wrong. Yahweh is beyond right and wrong. Each and every one of us must dig his own grave, or else be guilty of the pride of Lucifer. Once the mission begins, Moses is constantly led by God. The occasions come when he is in the mount 40 days and 40 nights. When Yahweh spake unto him face to face, as a man speaketh unto his friend. 40 days and 40 nights is a very long time to be in the supreme meditative state. The Buddha himself said, normally 7 days and nights, without a stop, without moving, eating or anything. And when he came down from Mount Sinai, he did not know that the skin of his face shone because he had been talking with God. You see, the Hebrews put it in a very esoteric form, so that only the few worthy ones, the so-called chosen ones, would be able to penetrate into the inner meaning of the whole thing. One of the reasons for that is that if a man isn't fit, isn't worthy of that kind of knowledge, he inevitably misuses it, because the unworthiness is principally manifested through self-centeredness. As long as there is self-centeredness, that is the very devil in one. Thus, Moses was transfigured. And later on in Exodus, you also find that Jacob speaks face to face with God. And he doesn't die. You know how the Old Testament it is said that if you meet God and know God, you will die. But everybody thinks that means that the organism will die. No. Mr. John Smith, if he meets God face to face and speaks with him, John Smith will not die. The organism will continue to live. But John Smith will be dead to all worldliness. That is what will die. And yet this Moses could be stirred to such fury when he heard the Israelites singing and saw the calf, a mere image before which they danced, that he broke the two tables of the testimony which were the work of Elohim. I should imagine, this is what I think, but I may be wrong, quite wrong. The two tables of the testimony means the whole bulk of the esoteric teaching, which actually existed in the Kabbalah. And the Kabbalah was brought westwards into Canaan by Abraham first. Abraham went out of Ur of the Chaldees, because the Chaldees had descended to magical practices. And he took the calf and burnt it in the fire, ground it to powder. If he burnt it in the fire, how did he grind it to powder? What is the real meaning of that? I don't know. Of course, if they say it was a golden calf, but if it was made of gold, it won't burn in the fire. It'll melt, but it won't burn. Anyhow, if you are interested, read your Exodus and try and work it out for yourself. And strewed it upon the water and made the Israelites drink of it. I wonder how many of them survived the drink. And thereafter, 3,000 of them were slain by the sons of Levi. Is it pronounced Levi or Levi? By the sons of Levi, I think. According to the word of Moses. So Moses really was responsible for a ghastly carnage. And this very man of God could even disobey Yahweh. In the desert of Zin, the Israelites chided Moses because they had no water. Then Yahweh told Moses to take his rod and speak to the rock which was before the eyes of the people. The rock and water, water the waters of life, of eternal life. But Moses took the rod and smote the rock twice instead of speaking to it. The waters flowed abundantly, but Yahweh said to Aaron and Moses, because ye believed me not to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore ye shall not bring this congregation into the land which I have given them. This is the water of Meribah. Meribah means strife. Because the children of Israel strove with Yahweh. And then the Bible says, and he was sanctified in them. He was not sanctified, actually, because Moses disobeyed. When the end came, and Moses went up from the plains of Moab unto the mountain of Nebo, to the top of Pisgah, that is over against Jericho. Jericho means the fragrant place. You have the same idea of getting to the fragrant place in the Kaushitaki Upanishad, when the disciple approaches the couch of Brahma. And Yahweh showed him the promised land, the land into which he was not allowed to enter because of his disobedience by the waters of Meribah.